Great series, great title. And we're looking at these really kind of tricky subjects represented by the four horsemen in the book of Revelation. Last week we looked at conquest, and Melanie talked about the environment, did a phenomenal job, I thought, about how... Yep. It's not going to be so good today. I'll just give you a heads up, okay? But today we're going to talk about war and conflict, and how can we have hope in that? The other subjects are famine. We're going to look at economic poverty next week, and then the final week we'll look at death. Can we have hope in death and in sickness and in all the sort of aspects of death that seem to affect our lives in the here and now, as well as thinking maybe a little bit about the hereafter. What's after this life? Is there such a thing as an afterlife? What does all that mean? So we're going to explore these issues that often seem despairing rather than hopeful, that often seem very dark and depressing. And war is one of those, right? I don't think nobody really could say, well, let's look on the bright side of war. War is, sometimes maybe that you could say throughout history there have been certain positive outcomes from war, but it's very often really hard to justify the means by the end, right, when it comes to war. So we're just going to look at this subject today. Now, I am no expert on war in any sense. I've not fought in any wars. I've not been in the military. I'm not a war historian. But that's never stopped me talking before, right, as you all well know. it's part of my job, right? Just talk about whatever the subject is. But what I wanted to do today is actually try to take a somewhat pastoral look at war. That might sound a little bizarre, but a more personal look at war, because I think part of the challenge is we're all in touch, I think, with the horror of war. We all know war is a major problem in the world. But it's somewhat removed from us, right? Because most of us probably have not experienced war. I think in the USA, the wars that this country has been involved in, especially in recent history, have not been on this soil, right? So people here have not necessarily experienced that for a long time. And then also, we're sort of disconnected because, most of the wars that are going on, again, they're sort of overseas, they involve other people. We might feel we have no real control over those things. We don't make those decisions to go to war or not to go to war. So it can feel somewhat removed. But I want to try this morning, if I can, and I'm not, let's see how this goes, but I want to try and bring it back to a more personal aspect. And in that personal aspect, find some hope, okay? So that's the way we're going to approach it this morning. So let's just start off with we're going to look at some statistics, some data about war, some of which I think is going to be, won't be surprising. Some of it might be a little more surprising. So I think it's probably not a surprise for us to hear, and we've heard this many times, that the 20th century, the last century, was the bloodiest, most deadly century in human history, right? We have a total of about 123 million people died in all the wars in the 20th century. We had two unbelievably catastrophic world wars in the first part of the century. I'm not going to recount all the bullet points there, but death, not just the actual battles themselves, but the fallout from battles and the famine and different things that happened. So there's this terrible legacy in the 20th century. But we know that kind of statistic, but we haven't necessarily really been hugely impacted by that, or it can feel very distant. But we're just going to sort of scroll through a few slides here. Let's look at the fact that in some way we are all connected to war. So, for instance, we spend a lot of money on war, right? As a human race, here's a military budget spending as a percentage of GDP. There are the different countries up there. Maybe we could go back just on that one. Sorry, you're trying to hurry me along. So, you've got USA there, number four, 3.5% of its GDP. Now we can go. So the USA is not the biggest spender on military per GDP, right? Necessarily. But look at this in terms of, this is from 2015, the discretionary budget of the USA. Huge amount of money, okay? Nearly $600 billion, over half the budget was spent on defense, on military. That's a huge amount. Okay, again, I'm not trying to justify or criticize that. It's just that How many of us pay taxes here? Does it? Yeah, you know, who doesn't pay taxes, right? Got a couple of IRS people at the back there. So that's our money, right? That's our money. So we are connected to this. We are spending money that results in purchase of weapons and all kinds of things. So, you know, and here's another graph that just shows. We're not going to look at these things in detail, but you know, spending is going up. This is U.S. spending since the 60s. Spending on the military is going up. It's not going down. That doesn't sound very hopeful, right, in many respects. Okay, and again, I want to make the point that this isn't, the U.S. isn't the only one. We saw that table earlier. Now, do you understand this graph? This is a really helpful, very easy to understand graph, right? Ignore the top bit there. Here's a different way, a slightly different perspective on all this. So what we've got here is the number of years per half century. So each one of these blocks represents half a century. And this is since 1500, right? And what this represents is the number of years, and this is a picture of Europe, okay? The number of years that European countries were at war or not. And what we can see here is that in Europe anyway, and let's face it, when you look at European history, we don't have a great track record with war, right? We've constantly been fighting each other. And we see that pattern here where it's very high. It's almost like we're constantly at war. But the trend is down. And actually, the second half of the 20th century, in terms of numbers of countries at war with each other, is relatively peaceful. Do you see that? So the amount of war, in one sense, is going down. And that's not just us peace-loving Europeans, because let's face it, we're not really. Let's look at the next slide. This is about global powers. You can't read this up here, but since 1898, USA was considered a global power. I don't know what before that, but obviously America has come to the fore in the last century or so. But even when we look at global power, so this is the amount of time spent the amount of time that global powers spent at war. This is the whole world, and you can see again since the year 1500, the trajectory is down. Right, so in other words, we seem to be getting better at some level at not going to war. I mean, if you look at these trends, and you know, we're not digging too deep into all this, but the trend seems down, which might be a hopeful thing. Now let's look at the next graph. We see here this is from battle deaths. So this is deaths of people involved in the actual warfare. And again, this is from the post-war. We see there was, you know, obviously there was a lot of war after the Second World War. We had, you know, the Korean War and other, you know, there was war in China. There was, you know, lots of different wars that continued on. But on the whole, the trend is down. Now, actually, since 2010, which is off the graph here, it's gone up again a little. But the trend here has been down. However, okay, so that seems like good news. That seems like more hopeful news that maybe we're, as humanity, you know, we're evolving to be more peaceful. Maybe it's out of, I wonder, and I think I can say probably as a European, I think we're just fed up of war because we've just been at war with each other for so long. It's like, it's almost, I don't know whether we're any better in terms of our consciousness so much as we are. We just don't want to go to war again, right? I mean, it may even be that. But let's look at this this next graph, and I don't know whether you can read this, but this is about total deaths from conflict. And here's where we see that first graph kick in, where we said the 20th century was the bloodiest century in human history. Here we've got deaths in the 20th century, you know, expressed as a percentage of world population, but also as a total amount here in millions. And we see it's far higher, despite the fact that there maybe have been fewer wars, maybe we're getting better at negotiating and coming to peace. There have been far more many deaths through war, even though there's less of them. And a couple of somewhat obvious conclusions from that, or inferences or reasons for that would be, what might be some reasons for that, would you say? What, you know, there is less war, but more death from war. Why might that be? Yeah. Technology, right? Technology. What does somebody say up here?
Better weapons.
Better weapons, yeah. Better is a relative term, right? Yeah. Yeah, so, and what else? What's another big one? More people, right? We have so many more people on the planet, so many more people concentrated into smaller areas, and we have way more destructive weapons. So in the old days, you know, going back to 1500 or so, you got a sword, and I mean, there's only so much damage you could do with that sword. I mean, just thinking about it. But now we can send, you know, and this is the problem with the First World War and the Second World War. Obviously, we began to see the use of bombs and that kind of thing in highly densely populated areas, and you can take out all kinds of people. And it doesn't matter how accurate you try to be and how pinpointed you try to be, the fallout from war for the average person is absolutely incredible. It's devastating. So we have a statistic like this where we have to categorically say the 20th century was the bloodiest century in all of human history. It seems that, and let's say perhaps we have our ability to, our emotional ability, our health, our spiritual ability, let's say perhaps, to handle technology is not in pace with our technological advances, right? I think we can see that in multiple areas in life. I mean, we can see it perhaps even with the information technological advances. They're in one sense, something like social media was meant to bring us all closer together, right? It's meant to be a unifying thing. We can connect with people, we can communicate. It would hopefully bring more unity. But very often that technology in our hands gets used in an emotionally destructive way, and it causes division and separation. And you think about the political climate, for instance, right now, when we've thrown social media into the mix, and how stressed that can be, and how much separation it can cause. I'm not saying that social media is evil. I'm just saying maybe our emotional capacity, our health as human beings, is not in pace with the incredible technological advances we've made. And I think you could say the same thing about weapons, right? Now I think we could say that about guns, right? And I, especially as an English person, stood up here in America talking about guns. I'm on very thin ice, right? I realize, because it's such a controversial subject. But maybe we just don't have the emotional capacity to handle the power of that kind of weapon. And you know, there was the data that came out after the last horrendous shooting in Las Vegas, which was that. I think since 1968, so in the last 50 years, total number of gun deaths within the U.S. was 1.5 million. Total number of deaths of Americans or American citizens from all the wars in American history is about 1.4 million. I mean, there's some debate about whether that was that data was accurate, but I looked into it and other people looked into it. It is actually accurate. So more people have died from guns in the last 50 years than all of than any American in all of the wars that America ever fought in. And that's a pretty terrifying piece of information, wouldn't you agree? Politics aside, it suggests that we have a major problem, and that problem is not just the issue of war in this remote, distant sense. It seems that it's more of a personal problem, right? Because this is within a nation. This is person to person. Now, let's look at, for instance, I think we've got to maybe go to the next slide. Looking at some data from the World Bank. Do we have that? The World Bank, the article I read about this, the World Bank didn't really quote the sources, but in current warfare, 90% of the casualties are from are civilians, right? Whereas a century ago, 90% were military personnel, right? There's been this big switch. Do we have the slides? Because I'm lost now. Okay, so I tell you what, it's gone, is it? Okay, I'll just keep talking. So the problem then is that I want to take this more personal look at war. War in some sense is becoming more personal because it's affecting civilians. It's affecting people who are not in armies, right? And that's because of these technological advances and higher population. But it's also perhaps due to the condition of the human heart, right? That violence is actually a very personal thing. It's not just a political thing. It's a very personal thing. So we've got this 90% civilian death rate in the current situation versus 90% military death rate in percentage of deaths in at the turn of the century. We also have the fact that now increasingly more and more people are dying from personal violence. I mentioned the gun situation here in the US, but it's not just the US. Across the world, 9 times more people die from interpersonal violence. That's gang violence, domestic violence, and the like, than from state-based war. Okay, so in other words, if we look at the nature of violence and war across our planet, it's much more personal, it's much more hand-to-hand, it's much more interpersonal and real, and it's based on the condition of the human heart, right? It's based on the fact that there is violence within all of us. And so as we think about this from a personal point of view, it seems that we have to own this aspect of violence in humanity, right? It's very easy for us, I think, to push that off and say, well, we're not like that. That's not how we are. But we're part of this, we're part of the human race. We participate in this being human experiment, if you like. So we're all part of it to one degree or another. And I think we see that very clearly at different points in time. Let me give you a little illustration of this from my life. So I'm going to tell you 2 stories, and I'm going to minimize some of the details on these stories because people can watch these messages online from anywhere in the world, right? So they're sort of public. And I want to tell the story in a way that nobody would be necessarily be able to identify themselves in the story. It's about nobody here, just so you know. But give you a couple of, I'm going to share a couple of altercations I had with different people that I've never met before in the last month or so. One was I was out kind of minding my own business and got into this situation where a person was challenging me about something. And I'm sorry I can't go into too much more detail than that. But they went from a one, as in they wanted me they asked me to move away from them for various reasons. They went from a 1 to a 10, where they were so aggressive and angry and offensive, and all kinds of bad language came out of their mouth, that I was like, whoa, I had to back away. I wasn't doing anything inappropriate, just so you know. It was just really bizarre, this explosive anger, and I backed away, right? I totally backed away. But for the rest of that day, I was, his confession, I was fantasizing about how I would get my own back on that person for being so obnoxious to me, right? Have you ever been through those kind of scenarios in your mind where somebody really offends you, somebody sort of goes out of the way, they're violent towards you, and in the moment, you know, you're not violent, maybe because that's not your disposition, but actually somehow internally, you know, you're just going through all these violent scenarios. Am I the only one who does that kind of thing? Am I? Lock me up now. Just lock me up. I was horrified by the violence in my own heart. I mean, it was like, oh my gosh. And I had to keep stopping myself. And then I would stop and think, oh, okay, I've got to stop being like that. And then 10 minutes later, I find myself doing it again, right? Because I'm so angry. And that anger leads to violence, at least in thought, okay? Another example. So that's not a great reaction, right? Another example, I was outside our house. When you come out of our house, you have to turn onto one of the main roads, you have to turn left, and there's a little hill to the right, and these cars come over that hill like at 90 miles an hour. Bit of an exaggeration, but they're coming over very fast. It's a 40-mile-an-hour limit. So it's really hard. If you're trying to turn left, you kind of look, it's clear, and then you just have to go really quick, because if somebody's coming over that hill and they're going too fast, there's going to be trouble. So I on this one occasion, pull out, nothing there, pull out. This guy comes flying over the hill, and, you know, I've done this before, so I know that if you're going at 40, there's plenty of time to slow down, right? But if you're going way faster than that, there's not enough time to slow down. So he comes right up behind me, and I had to swerve off the road to stop him running into the back of me. So I pull over. He pulls over in front of me, gets out of his car. You can all see what's coming. Gets out of his car, and he starts dishing it out about how I nearly killed him. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm not the one in the wrong here. So I put my window down, press the button, it goes down. And I said, do you know, and I was pretty calm about it. Do you know, the problem is you are going too fast. It's not the fact that I pulled out. You're going too fast, and you need to, you know, I said something like you need to own that. It was probably a little more flowery language than that, but nothing too bad, though. Anyway, the guy gets his face in mine and says, next time I see you, I'm going to shoot you, right? So, okay, so I'm like, oh. But the thing there, and I can't explain this, but I didn't have... I think I was so shocked at the violence of it, you know, that it would go to that, that I just thought, and I'm not worried about getting, I don't think he's going to shoot me, right? I mean, and I've never seen him again since. I actually wanted to cry. Fortunately, I didn't cry. Not because, oh my gosh, he's going to shoot me, but because it was just tragic. It's just tragic. And somehow in that situation, whereas in the other one, I was like, I'll show him what's what and all the rest of it. In this one, I was like, oh my gosh, how does it come to that? How does it come to that? So, I felt some degree of empathy, right? I don't know, it's not because I'm a great person. I don't know where that came from. I think it was just the shock of it or whatever, but it was like, we are in such trouble, right? As humanity, we are in such trouble. And this is, I'm part of the problem, I experienced the problem, and when we translate that into situations, when we start putting weapons into hands of people in different scenarios, there's all kinds of problems, right? So it's our problem. It's a problem of the human heart. It seems that the issues here of violence, of anger, are related, let me put this out there as a possibility at least. They're related to issues of power and control, right? And that power and control is all to do with fear. It's to do with the opposite of love. It's to do with fear. Jesus said, perfect love, Jesus' followers said, perfect love casts out fear, right? Perfect love casts out fear. So fear is the opposite of love. And fear leads us to want to control things, right? We're afraid of what might happen if we don't exert power. We all experience this, in everyday life, right? We if we have power, we like to use that power to get what we want, right? I think most of the time that's, it's in kind of like, maybe it's in work situations or in family situation. We might sort of exert a bit of power, a bit of bullying, a bit of, whatever to sort of, apply pressure to get what we want. It's not necessarily fair, but it doesn't seem all that unfair. But extrapolate that out and you have a situation like Harvey Weinstein, he was able to do because he had power, right? He actually could do all that stuff because he had power. And so he exerts that power in an aggressive, violent way, and then we're all shocked. It's like, how can that happen? How could that be possible? But to some degree, perhaps there's some of that in all of us, right? And that, I'm in no way wanting to justify anything that has happened. But I think we all have to look at our own use of power and our own desire for power and our own application of power. And once that comes out of fear, once we start using that out of fear, once we start using that to manipulate people, to abuse people, we've got to own that. We've got to address that and own it. The other thing is lack of power, right? There are people committing all sorts of atrocities. You think of some of the acts of terrorism that happen from people who feel they have no power. They're desperate. They're just lashing out indiscriminately, killing people who they don't know, and they themselves have been manipulated by other people who have power. But lack of power, when we're feeling threatened, when we're feeling attacked, we that can make us back up or lash out. And in both of these situations, where we have power and where we don't have power, and it leads to fear, and our life is gives into fear rather than to love, we end up with violent situations, right? We end up with all kinds of anger. And we talked in a series of, I think the series before last, over the summer, we talked a lot about this and about the need for empathy, the need for forgiveness, the need for addressing the issues in our own lives and building bridges, and the need for reconciliation, the need for forgiveness to come out of a basis of love rather than fear. We talked about all those things. over the course of that series, you remember we talked about recognizing that everybody's struggling, right? We said everybody's nuts, everybody's crazy, everybody has a story. Everybody, and this is perhaps the biggest stretch, everybody's doing their best. If we can, in our personal lives, be peacemakers and peace builders, it's going to have to start at that kind of level, right? Of us addressing the violence and the anger in our own hearts. Let's just, for a moment, do we have any slides at all? We do. Okay, so let's go to the scriptures. So if we can put this, let's just look at some scriptures here. Okay, so first of all, when we think about violence, when we think about war, the Bible can be a pretty violent book, right? Has anybody ever found that? That there's all kinds of violence actually in the Bible. And I wanted to say that I think there are many voices in the Bible, okay? So this is sort of, I guess, context for even looking at some of the passages. There are voices in the Bible that seem about power and about political power and about control. And, you know, my sense is when we read in the Bible that the people of Israel were led into the Promised Land, what was called the Promised Land, and they were told to kill everybody, you know, in some of those stories we read that kind of thing. I think that's a political voice. But there's another voice that speaks in a very different kind of way, and that's often the prophetic voice. And in Isaiah, one of the great prophets, we have this much more peaceful ideal spoken about that we're to pursue. Okay, it says, many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations and will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. So there's this ideal of peace, right, of pursuing peace, of being about peace. In the context of a world, a climate, you know, this is the 8th century BCE, this is a climate when there's war all over the place and there's all kinds of violence. So there's this ideal that seems to be emerging that it's not about fighting. We want peace. So this is a very hopeful ideal. I would say more than ever, we need to be pursuers of peace, right? Jesus said in Matthew 5, so the beginning of what's become known as the Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the peacemakers. In the Message version, it puts it like this. I think this is a great way of expressing it. You are blessed when you can show people how to cooperate instead of compete or fight. That's when you discover who you really are and your place in God's family. So here comes Jesus in the middle of a brutal occupation by the Roman military machine, and he's talking about peace. He's talking to the people who might be most justified to rise up and fight. He's talking to them about peace. That's a pretty amazing thing. And Jesus comes to us now, I believe, at a time when, as I was saying, perhaps more than ever, we need to find another way. And this is why I have hope, right? Because it's hard when we think about the world, when we think about war, when we think about the human heart, the human condition, it's really hard to have hope. But the reason I have hope is because Jesus comes with this other way, that it's possible to be a peacemaker. It's possible to pursue a way that is non-violent, that we can pursue a way within relationships, within our discourse socially, within our political arena, that is non-violent, that can find another way to the tit-for-tat response of violence for violence. Jesus came into that horrendous situation saying, it's possible. It's a really hopeful thing. We may find that hard. We may find that a struggle, but that struggle is our hope, right? That's what I believe Jesus is saying, don't give up on this. Don't give up on this hopeful way. Now, Jesus went on in the same section of Matthew's gospel, and you know, our understanding is he kind of gave this teaching all in one go, most likely. He says some things which some of these scriptures are very familiar to us. We're going to read them from the Message, which is a more modern translation. So it kind of perhaps gives us a fresh perspective. You're familiar with the command to the ancients, do not murder. I'm telling you that anyone who is as much as angry with a brother or a sister is guilty of murder. Carelessly call a brother idiot, and you just might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister, and you're on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill. So this is Jesus getting at the human heart, right? Saying, hey, you know, you may not have committed murder, you may not do all these things, but what's in your heart? What kind of anger, what kind of resentment, what kind of prejudice, what kind of hatred is there in the human heart? Jesus goes on to say, here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? Here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues you for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. This is hard to take, right? And if someone takes their unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice servant life. Interestingly, in the literal translation there is from saying if somebody gets you to walk a mile, do that and walk a second mile. And that was a direct reference to what a Roman soldier could require of you. So the oppressor could say, hey, you've got to carry my stuff for a mile. Legally, they could do that. Jesus, in that context, is saying, hey, just outdo them with generosity and kindness and walk a second mile. It's a whole different kind of way of bringing about change, a whole different way of countering violence and violent behavior. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law. Love your friend and its unwritten companion. Hate your enemy. I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer, for then you're working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. He gives his best, the sun to warm and the rain to nourish, to everyone, regardless, the good, the bad, the nice and the nasty. I love that. The nice and the nasty. Sounds like a movie, doesn't it? The good, the bad, the nice and the nasty. You know, we've heard all this before, right? This is nothing new. I guess it's trying to connect that, saying this is at the heart of our problem with conflict, our problem with war. It's in our relationships. It's in our politics, right? Perhaps why this nonviolent way, this way that wants to pursue understanding of the other, that rather than responding tit for tat, wants to outlove the other, outserve the other, even when it seems lunacy to do so. Perhaps we need that more than ever right now, partly because we're so polarized, right? We're so polarized. Even talking about the subject of war, talking about guns, makes me kind of nervous because it's like the potential for offense and the potential for us to withdraw to our political defenses is so strong. And that's so somehow in our country, in our world, we have to find a way to come together and bring about healing, right? I mean, we've got to find a way to do that. That inevitably means a whole bunch of people are going to have to change their minds about a whole bunch of things, right? And obviously, we all think they need to change their minds, and they all think we need to change our minds, right? But there's a lot of change that needs to happen. I'm not just saying it's like, let's all link arms and sing Kumbaya and pretend nothing's wrong. I'm not saying, Jesus is absolutely not saying, let's not say anything or do anything. But I think Jesus is saying, actually, do something. But it's a different kind of doing something. And this is crucial, I think, for us. It's crucial for us to look at what is going on in our own hearts. Again, I think that's why we can have hope, because we get to do something about that. We get to do something about this in a way that it might seem we are less empowered to do something about what's going on out there or even what's going on around us. Now, I'm going to shift gears here. Are we back on with slides? So, okay. At the end, when we were talking earlier about some of the statistics and data, we were talking about war becoming more personal. Right, we were talking about how it impacts different people in different ways. It's impacting civilians way more now than ever. And one of the things we were going to talk about a little bit there was just the way in how it's impacted our world to such an extent that we now have 65 million people who have been displaced, not exclusively by war, but many refugees who, as a result of war, have had to flee their countries, move to other countries, move often to several countries, and many of whom, some of whom have come to the U.S. and to other countries. And obviously, this is another big political issue, right? I think it's very easy to think of that statistics like that, 65 million. That's about one in every 122 people on the planet being displaced. It becomes a political issue. It becomes a news item. But it's real life. It's real people. And this morning, I wanted to talk with somebody who has experienced that, right? Somebody who has been through this. And we've met this person once before because they came to one of our services last year. And his name is Vile. And I'm going to invite Vile. Would you like to come on up? Vile is from Syria. Let's give him a really warm welcome. Okay, you can sit down. It's great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to ask Vile just to share some of his story, because probably for most of us, I mean, actually, we could do a show of hands on this. Has anybody been involved in direct war conflict? I mean, has anybody been in a situation like that, lived in a country, or been in, maybe served in the military? Has anybody heard? So there's a few people, right? I had a little bit of that when I worked as a doctor in Central America back in the 80s. There were, brushed with it, I would say, rather than directly involved. And it's an awful, terrifying thing. But again, it's somewhat removed from us. Vile has experienced that firsthand. I'm just going to give a little bit of introduction. We've got a map of Syria, I think, just that, that's going to come up. Because you are from Homs, right, Vile? So you can see Homs there on the western part of the country. And then just a couple of photos. I think many of us will have heard of Homs because of the destruction that has happened there. That's a result of the war in Syria that began around about 2010, 2011. And it's a comparison shot here. I don't know whether you've seen this. I'm sure you're tired of seeing photos like this yourself, but. That's war, right? That's the war situation. But again, it can feel somewhat remote for us. I think we have one more. That's it. Is that it now? Okay. So tell us a little bit, Vile, of your story. You lived in Homs and you you studied there as well, right? So just tell us a little bit about your story and how it came about that you had to leave.
Yes, okay. Actually, first time I would like to say thank you very much to invite me today. And I'm very happy here with you. Okay.
Thank you. We're happy that you're here as well. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, maybe my English is not good. So if I have a mistake, I'm sorry. Okay. My name is Wael. I'm from Syria, from Homs. I'm 27 years old. Actually, I can explain. In 2011, the war started in my country, and I have never expected that would be happen in my country. I remember that. When I had the last exam in my college, there's too much things or too much happened there in my country. It was very difficult and, too many things happened there that time.
Yeah. You studied, tell us a little bit about what you studied.
Yeah, I finished my study in my country. In college, like here, 2 years in general engineering survey section, school plan like this, But yes.
And what you studied civil engineering?
In 2009 maybe.
Yeah.
And I finished in 2011.
Yeah.
When the war started, that I finished my study there.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about. I know you were sharing with me that it got to a point when you finished. Your studies, you had to join the army, right? You were required, and the war was going on at that point,
right?
And so that would meant really you would had to join in that war. Tell us how you felt about that.
Yes. Actually, everybody in my country should go to the army after maybe 18 years. But if you study, you stay. Study, after that, you must go. And to be go to army, you know. So when I finished my study, the government gave me like letters, and they told you must go to the army. But I don't like go there because I don't know. If you go there, you should kill people, and I don't like kill people without any reason, you know. But
that's a good thing.
Yeah. Yes. Another thing, if you don't go to the army, you will die, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you knew that if you were going to say no, I don't want to do that, and you knew you had to leave, right?
Yeah.
Because you would be in danger. As
right. Yeah.
So tell us about leaving. What happened there?
Yes. You know, when I finish my study, I should go to army, but I don't like it. Actually, I have my cousin, he is engineer already in Saudi Arabia. I called him and told if he has chance to go to Saudi Arabia and work there. And yes, he told me, and I prepared my paper, prepared myself to go to Saudi Arabia. And the war started at the same time. Yes, and I leave my country illegal, not illegal, you know. Mm. So, you know, I leave my country. I don't like to go to army and kill people.
So you left it and you went to Jordan, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that was where. And eventually, the UN said there was an opportunity to come to America, right, under the refugee program.
Mm-hmm.
How long from leaving Syria to coming to the U.S. was it? How long did it take from leaving Syria to coming to the U.S. last year?
Yes. In 2011, I leave my country.
2011.
Yes. And I stay in Jordan 4 years because, you know, told you before, Saudi Arabia closed the door in front of the to any people from Syria to go there. And I stay in Jordan 4 years.
So while I was saying that, you know, there were numerous options to go to other places depending on family, but you know, lots of countries were shutting the doors to Syrian refugees especially, and so went to Jordan and then eventually came to the U.S. last year.
Yes, I have been in America 1 year.
Yeah. And then tell us a little bit about how has it been in America, like what's your experience been coming here
before
for the last year or so, you know, when you came September last year.
Yes.
Right, you came.
Yes,
tell us a little bit about that.
Before or during last year?
This last year.
Yes.
When you arrived.
Yeah, when I arrived. Actually, when I arrived here in America, we stay without work 2 months, and ECDC company organization from refugees help people. Actually, if any people from like refugees, and you know, but they have a lot of refugees. Mm-hmm. They told us, you are young. You can depend on yourself, and you can find a work, and you can start here without helping after that, because we have a lot of people who need help. And yes.
And things have gone. I know when I met you last year, it was kind of difficult, and you were working
right. I worked last year like warehouse in Baltimore, Sephora company, like makeup.
Sephora, that's right, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know how to go there. When I arrived here in America, I don't know anybody, but I know somebody has a van, and he has a job in Sephora. He collects the people around home and take people go there and work, you know.
But some changes. So there's been some really cool changes this year because you started teaching Arabic, right?
Yes.
Which is great. And then you met somebody from teaching. You met somebody,
yes,
right, who was able to help you get another job.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about what you're doing now.
Yeah. Okay. Last year, a woman from Syria, I think, but she lives here already. She is American. She helps refugees people. And she invited me, like a woman here, American. She's named Merit. Merit. She is American. She likes to learn Arabic, and I know Arabic already. My language is already. I taught her for one, maybe or three, four times Arabic. She has husband. Her husband is engineer. And then I invite him. He's very kind, and he helped me to find a new job. But before that, I leave my job in Sephora. Before that, I leave Sephora, and I worked in bakery. It's near to my home, because Sephora is very far. It takes two hours to arrive there, and go back 2 hours.
Yeah,
you're
going on the bus, right, to Baltimore from Riverdale Park, so that's a long way.
Yes, right, yeah. And you should pay for that.
Yeah,
I leave my first job, and I start to work in bakery. It's near, and it's free transportation for that.
Yeah.
And I have a time to go to take English class, you know, before I can't take any classes in English, because all time, all days, like this. I have just 1 day off. I work 10 hours in Sephora, but in a bakery, I work just 8 hours, you know?
Yeah. And the new job is working with engineering, right? So you're getting more back to what you studied.
Yeah,
correct?
it's very surprised when I know my friend, he is engineer already, and he helped me to find a job. And actually, another lady is American here. She helped me to create a new CV, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very helpful to.
Yeah.
To
that's great.
Yes.
That's so great.
Yes.
So we're done. Thank you so much for sharing that story with us. So you can go sit back down.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it. That is. So it's so courageous to come up and talk to us like that. Thank you so much. And you know, I think we have there. That's just a little snapshot, right, of a real life, a real story in situations that we generally only read about or see on the news. But it's very personal, right? It's very real. And in the discussion questions this week, we have discussion questions for each of these messages. So you can get a copy of those. We have hard copies outside, and you can also get them online. And the discussions questions this week, on the back of the discussion questions is information about how any single one of us can help with refugees in our country. You know, the story that we just heard there from Wael is essentially people helping people, right? It's a very personal thing, and we have an opportunity where we can help people who are trying to make a new start in this country, people who have had to come from all kinds of horrendous situations. So do check that out. Just in closing, we're going to sing a song to close out in a second. Let me say again, this is a big subject. This is a tricky subject. And, I want to come back again to the fact that I'm no expert, right, on all these issues. There are many political challenges, many political complications, right? There are no simple answers. The world is a really complex place. I guess in the middle of it all, perhaps we could just think about our own lives and our own issues to do with violence and anger and the kinds of things that cause us to fight in our relationships, in our political discourse, in our societies, and even in our international discourse politically, and take a look at what's really going on there. And we can be part of something different, right? There's so much that we can't affect, But we can choose to be, as followers of Jesus, to be part of a very different future. And that future is really hopeful. I don't think it's just going to come along and happen without a huge amount of struggle. But part of what we're about here is encouraging one another and helping one another in that struggle, along the way in that struggle. So let's just for a moment close our eyes. Again, I want to point you to the discussion questions afterwards. There's some challenges there and some things to reflect on, some ways we can each respond, various ways we can each respond. But right here and now, let's just open our hearts. Let's open our hearts to the giver of life, to the one who is in all and in whom all is, to the one who takes all this hatred and strife and disagreement and injustice and hurt and pain and just takes it in and loves us. Lord, we want to be part of something different. We want to be part of another way. So come. Come to us in all of our conflict. Come to us in our pain. Lord, we as human beings, we as part of humanity, cry out and say we don't know at times the first thing to do. We're lost. So God, we're reaching out to you. Come, Holy Spirit, fill us, empower us. Empower us with your love. And may your love cast out fear. Amen. Let's sing this song to close.